For a decade, from 1975, Tony Harcup was a mainstay of Leeds' other paper, the alternative newspaper serving that city. Since then, he's worked in conventional media and now works as a lecturer at the University of Sheffield. He's just published Alternative Journalism, Alternative Voices, a collection of his writings about how the alternative press in Britain during the 1970s and 1980s operated. I first asked him what it was that got him interested in writing for the alternative press.
When I was at school, I started producing a sort of a magazine, which I wouldn't have thought of as alternative media, but looking back, was an example of alternative media because it was taking a very alternative take on the school's policies and regimes. And this was not a kind of a nice twee middle class school. This was a very working class inner city school. So this was not really the done thing. I suppose that sort of laid the foundations. But I was, I suppose, always asking questions, and so I was the sort of person who would notice things. So I kind of, even when I was at school, I noticed that the fact that there was an alternative press, you know, I would notice that people were selling socialist worker outside tube stations and sometimes buy one and read it and notice that there was a sort of anarchist bookshop in Aldgate and pop in and pick up some odd bit of literature. I was just kind of interested. So I was sort of aware of it, really. And then I moved to Leeds to go to university, and within a few days noticed a copy of Leeds Other Paper in a newsagent and bought it, liked it, and it said, anyone who wants to get involved, you know, come along to our open meetings. And so I did, and really that was my introduction to journalism. And I was probably 18 at the time, and I've been involved one way or another ever since.
And what was the scene that you came upon? I mean, tell me a little bit about that meeting and perhaps some of the early production process.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we're talking 1975, so we're talking lots of paper, carbon copies, typewriters, electric typewriters and old-fashioned typewriters to type the copy. We're talking people who were, I mean, that paper had come out of quite a lot of quite committed anarchists. I mean, I was always much more vaguely left-wing rather than specific organizations or specific ideologies. But there were quite a lot of, you know, people involved in the anarchist movement, put broadly speaking, and anti-racist and anti-apartheid and feminist and, you know, general, you know, 1970s politics were in the air. And but what struck me about the paper was, well, a number of things, but it was a journalistic process. I mean, they were keen to write a paper that had news in it, that had reporting in it, that went out talking to people. So it wasn't just, you know, screeds of propaganda. It wasn't just, you know, this is how rich the rich are and isn't it a horrible world. It was, you know, going to housing estates, talking to people, interviewing them, writing down their comments, making articles out of people, ordinary people's lives, and some of those ordinary people, you know, very, very few, but, you know, some, would occasionally come along to meetings and join in discussions and arguments, and it would, you know, so it was a really fluid sort of process. And we would, on the sort of editorial meetings, we would just spend 2 or 3 hours discussing as every article that we could that was passed around on sheets of paper and carbon copies, make a few notes. And somebody would go out and get a few beers, and we'd then talk long into the night about what story should be on the front page and what story should go on the spike, and whether, you know, what, why this issue was even being covered at all. It wasn't of any interest to us, or you know, whether somebody had been interviewed. Why did we interview them? Why didn't we interview them? It was the classic thing. People always say, "Oh, you can't edit by committee." And we never called ourselves a committee. It was probably a collective or a cooperative, but we did edit by, you know, by a cooperative, and it kind of worked. Especially in the early days, it was, when I got involved, it was a fortnightly paper, and I actually think that was a brilliant timescale. We later went weekly, and under pressures of production of a weekly, some of that open democracy gradually ebbed away because it, you know, it kind of interfered with the production process. And I noticed that, I mean, Private Eye, fantastically successful in terms of its sales, has kept that fortnightly cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it kind of keeps you sane. So I do think there was, you know, something about that fortnightly cycle. But again, in contrast to a lot of the sort of the underground press and the hippie press and all that kind of stuff that came before, I mean, a lot of those papers would just kind of appear whenever people got it together and nobody ever knew, really. But the people who created Leeds Other Paper, which was before I was involved, they very definitely decided this is going to be a newspaper, it's going to be regular, we want it to be on sale in newsagents, we want people to know when it's coming out, when the next issue is, and it, you know, it stuck to that that regular cycle, was first as a monthly, then as a fortnightly, and then as a weekly, so for 20 years. Quite an achievement.
And I know that you've written about the way in which the news values were different and the way in which stories were handled differently. But, I mean, perhaps, you know, in the context of the handling of a particular story, could you sort of give me some idea of how that worked and how what the differences were?
Well, yes. I mean, I think I can remember, well, a number of times, you know, like when there'd be strikes, there'd be industrial disputes. And, of course, in the 70s, I mean, we went through the winter of discontent and all that, but even before that, the fire brigades, union strikes and everything. You know, and the classic way in which they were reported in the bulk of the media, certainly the bulk of the regional media, which really were our competitors, would be you'd have the union full-timer giving his view, and it almost always was a he giving his view, and, you know, the perspective from the management. And we always tried to avoid having anything from union full-timers, partly because that was a sort of at the anarchist politics that had seeped in, you know, that but more because you wanted to hear it from the horse's mouth. So we would, you know, spend ages going out at unearthly hours of the night or early in the morning to picket lines to talk to the ordinary people on strike. Okay, they are the people who have bothered to picket, so they are not union full-timers, not people with positions, often didn't want to give you their name, but that's okay, we'll have that. So just to talk to people, and I mean, you get, just by doing that, you obviously get better quotes, really. You get a better perspective, and sometimes they'd be slagging off their own union as well. And so you'd get a more rounded picture, but also you'd just get some of that sense of human life. You know, you get the humour. You know, any bunch of workers that are together are going to have jokes and their own language about their workplace, their own nicknames for their bosses or things like that, which fed into the coverage. But it, of course, it's very labour intensive, and it's not a terribly economic way of reporting, because, you know, you can't just ring up one side, ring up the other side, bash out the story. It involves investment of some hours and often repeat visits, because when you first turn up, they think, who the hell are you? I'm not going to talk to you. So you kind of have to show a bit of commitment and stickability. So in that sense, you'd only do that if you felt it was worthwhile. So I mean, that would be one example, but that would stretch throughout everything. So housing stories, which are always big stories, council estates, you know, it does mean turning up at tenants' meetings and befriending people and knocking on doors, talking to people, you know, literally knocking on doors in many cases, people who didn't have telephones, certainly back in the 70s, you know, not just mobile phones, but not any phones. Again, it was that beginning from the perspective of tell it from the point of view of the people at the bottom, but preferably the people at the bottom who are trying to do something about it, so that you're offering not just a picture of negativity, isn't the world horrible, and to be frank, the paper did sometimes come across a bit like that, you know, here's another story about a damp house, here's another story about a damp house, here's a damp picture of somebody at a damp house, but wherever possible, we'd be emphasising the, quotes, ordinary people who were doing something about it. And that was, you know, that was always the aim. That was the classic Leeds Other Paper news story.
And, I mean, you mentioned the amount of effort that it would take. Would that always be a labour of love, or was it able to generate some kind of return?
Well, some of us earned a wage of sorts for a few years. We had a printing press, and we had, as the 80s went on, we had sort of typesetting machines, so we would do printing and typesetting for, well, commercially for anybody, but usually it was, you know, campaigns or trade unions or people on the left or little community groups, And, you know, we made that subsidized the paper a bit, and the paper did take advertising from all the usual suspects like Whole Foods shops and and the like, and gigs, lots of people putting on gigs. That managed to bring in enough income to maintain virtually a city centre office. Leeds was a bit cheaper in those days than it is now. And some wages, although there were times when wages were paid very late, times when wages were scarcely not paid at all, and they were always pretty low. But, you know, it was a job as well. You know, it was my first job in journalism, and I spent 10 years at it. And that, you know, that was my only income for those 10 years. So I did learn to live on a shoestring, which has stood me in good stead ever since.
And there was obviously, sort of from the early 70s, perhaps until the late 80s, quite a big national scene, or at least local examples of this of alternative press all over the UK. How would you sort of characterise the scale of that?
I've seen lots of lists. I've actually compiled a few lists myself, and nobody will ever know because, you know, some of these things lasted one or two issues and then died a death, and there was no real sort of register. I mean, there were two or three national newspaper conferences. I certainly refer to one of them in the book that was took place during the miners' strike, which was certainly after the heyday, really. I say the 70s were probably the heyday. But papers would spring up in, you know, in sort of surprising places. But certainly, I mean, just in, you know, the ones I was most familiar with when I was at Leeds Other Paper, just nearby, there was one in Bradford Banner, there was Huddersfield Hammer, there was York Free Press, there was Sheffield Free Press, then there was Sheffield City Issues, there was the Rochdale Alternative Paper. You know, I mean, Rochdale, not a big city, but that was a very very successful paper, in fact. Partly, perhaps, because it was a slightly smaller place, they could make bigger waves. There was one in Barnsley, I think, called Sting, that was slightly earlier than us. And all around the country. I mean, in parts of London, there was one in Shepherd's Bush, Shepherd's Bush News, Islington Gutter Press, Hackney People's Press, you know, and no doubt a lot more. I mean, this was partly the offset Livo printing, you know, opened up, made things cheaper, because really before the late 60s, early 70s, people thought of printing a paper, you know, it was, you had to take it to some big printer, and it all seemed more cumbersome, whereas the offset Livo was something that people could learn to do. I mean, the people who printed the early editions of Leeds Other Paper just taught themselves how to do it, and on a second-hand machine that was bought with money raised from a jumble sale. I mean, it was all over, but it was everywhere. Every paper was a bit different. You know, none of them were copying each other. None were the same. You know, some would have a lot on certain issues, you know, loads of environmental stuff, and others would scarcely have that. Some emphasised a lot more sort of alternative arts scene, whereas others were much more into trade union struggles, and they were all different, all sort of vibrant in their own ways, and some lasted very short space of time, some lasted a long time, but I always think even the ones that last a short time, they kind of, you know, did at least ask a few questions about, you know, what journalism is for.
And yet they all went into a terminal decline on the eve of the sort of technological problems of production and distribution being solved.
That is a good argument against technological determinism, because it's not the technology that makes things possible. It's people make the technology possible, and then people utilise the technology or not. And what had happened, I mean, when Leeds Other Paper folded in 1994, more or less, simultaneously with Tim Berners-Lee doing his stuff, I think. No, it folded because the people involved had run out of energy, run out of money, and the numbers of people involved were far fewer, and not many new people were coming along. And all of that was to do with the political tide. Though Thatcher had gone, the effects of Thatcherism were still being felt, and the sort of the political tide had gone out, probably from the, you know, the defeat of the miners' strike and whopping. It limped on into the 90s, limped on to 94. But, yeah, the sort of the political groundswell, or I'm mixing metaphors, but, you know, the political groundswell or the political tide had sort of ebbed, and it was individual people could keep it going, but when those individual people had kind of had enough, they didn't even, at least the paper closed without warning, you know, there was not even a, look, we're going to have to close in a month's time unless people can raise some money or unless more people get involved. They literally didn't have enough money to buy any more paper. So they scraped together all the last bits of paper in the building and printed one final valedictory issue. It closed without any prior warning to the readers. No chance for people to get involved and save it. And had they put in an appeal, maybe people would have saved it and then maybe it would have closed 6 months later or a year later, because the political tide had sort of changed. That's it. The technology itself, although the technology does make some things possible, it doesn't make them happen. You still need the people and the political will and all that to make it happen.
Might there be an alternative argument that the novelty of Litho and the IBM golf ball typewriter had perhaps worn off, that the mainstream media had incorporated an awful lot of lessons that it possibly had learnt from the alternative media, listings, a lot of gig reviews, and that maybe investigative journalism, which I suspect was seen as the crown jewels of journalism in the 70s on the back of Woodward and Bernstein, had perhaps, some of the interest in that had dissipated.
Yeah, I think there's some truth in probably some truth in all those arguments. Certainly that the mainstream media picked up on something like listings in a big way. I mean, you know, it's hard for people to believe now that there was a time before listings. But when the alternative press pioneered listings, I mean, mainstream newspapers didn't want to know. They said, no, we're not going to say what's on at the pictures. They can take out an advert. So it's true that the alternative has sort of seeped in and influenced. In some ways, it's true that maybe some of the that sort of image of investigative journalism had sort of faded a bit, but an awful lot of the alternative press, the local alternative press, didn't necessarily do that much investigative journalism. But you know, the bread and butter of what papers like Leeds Other Paper and Rochdale were doing was reportage. It was just from the bottom up rather than the top down. It was very much the exception, even in the alternative press. It will be a mixture of all these things happening. And back when I started, people were always coming into our office because there was campaigns about this, campaigns about that, and it was sort of vibrant. You know, they're coming in, they wanted to get leaflets printed about their campaign, which then feeds into stories, and you're making contacts, you go along, and there was just so many different organizations doing things. But by the time it closed, there just weren't. And there was a bit of a defeated feeling in the air, really.
And do you see anything now that's carrying that torch forward?
Yeah, I do. I mean, in the last chapter of the book, I wrote about the Manchester Mule. Mule as in news with a kick. I think that's its strapline. And that, I think, is the nearest sort of online equivalent to what Leeds Other Paper in the 70s or 80s was doing. But, it's doing it with added online elements. I mean, it does have bits of video and bits of audio. Not a lot. It's still mainly text. And it has comments facilities, and it tweets all its stories and all the rest of it. You know, it's a younger generation of people doing it, and they are doing journalism. You know, they are doing reporting. They are talking to people, talking to sources, and then because it's all online, they're linking to original documents, linking to material. And I think, you know, there's not a lot around. You know, maybe we're still at the very early stages of this. You know, maybe there will be more. And, you know, maybe some individuals do it as well. I mean, I was interested to hear on the radio the other morning, the woman blogger who's been, I think she was trying to film her local council meeting. The councillor taken action against her to stop her doing that. And, you know, she's obviously an individual with no journalistic training as far as I could see, but who, as a concerned citizen on her own, decided to go and keep tabs on what her local council were doing and write about it on her blog, and then she wanted to extend that by filming it. And because that's kind of easy to do in some ways, because you don't have to distribute the paper like we had to, you know, maybe we will see more of that. You know, I don't think we've seen anywhere near as much as those sort of triumphalist voices about so-called citizen journalism would have us believe. This new technology, I mean, we are still incredibly early on, aren't we? I mean, you know, we're probably in the digital equivalent of about the year 1500 when print was, you know, about 25 years after print came on board.